On the phone with us, Drew Hardesty from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center. Good morning.
We're on the back end of a danger curve. We're at moderate danger for human-triggered avalanches. These are primarily on the steep mid and upper elevation, northerly through easterly facing slopes. Human-triggered slides 1 to 2 feet deep, 200 feet wide, remain possible. Of course, they can still be triggered from adjacent terrain or below. Collapsing is still noted by numerous parties in the backcountry. Those snow pit tests are providing maybe inconsistent results, and that's sort of in lockstep with being on the backside of the curve. Of course, last week, just after the storms, it was all in your face, natural avalanches, cracking, collapsing, remotely triggered slides everywhere. Things were very obvious that it was dangerous. Things are less obvious, so, but still it's tricky because it may still be possible to trigger one of these avalanches. Really, the safest and arguably best riding still remains on the low-angle terrain and the sheltered, shady slopes. Hopefully the storm will pan out for this weekend and freshen things up. Of course, for more information, people can always go to the UtahAvalancheCenter.org.
Okay. Drew, thanks.
Hey, thanks, Leslie.
Mike Davis, good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's start with Mayflower. Last we spoke, the two of the parcels, the Mountain and North parcel, had sold. A third was waiting for the state to sign off on the tailings remediation. Any updates there?
No, they're proceeding with that. I think that they're very close in completing the tailings remediation, and they're just working out the details on their sale. We're also working on finalizing getting the necessary dedications for the Jordanelle Parkway Road, which will go from the Mayflower exit up along the lake to the Browns Canyon intersection. So there's quite a bit happening right at this moment there.
Right. And then with the other two developments, I mean, have you seen full applications for those?
Well, they have their density determinations. So as soon as they have the road, which is will be necessary for their access and their secondary accesses, they'll do their applications for their first phase finals. So they're just waiting on getting those dedications done, and I think we'll see those applications within a month or two.
Okay. Haven't seen much with MIDA for the military hotel. Any news there? I think they were still trying to decide on a location, right?
They're actually working on a couple of different locations. One of the developers on the west side with the Extel Corporation is going through the necessary NEPA requirements in order for the military to own property. It has to be qualified by the NEPA process, and so they're several months into that process now, and anticipate that this the next few months they'll have that available and will make the transfers necessary, and that will trigger a lot of things once that happens.
Now, you say the density determination has already been made. What are we talking about here? I mean, give us a perspective of how many units could eventually be built there.
Well, currently, with the approvals in place, there's probably around 2,000 equivalent residential units approved. There can be another probably 2,000 on the west side within the next few years. So we're looking at in the neighborhood of 4,000 to 6,000 once they get through all of those processes.
And when you hear those numbers and see that, what, I think your growth rate at 4%, does that give you any concern?
It is some concern. One of the things about it is that most of the, like Summit County, about 50% of the units that are built here are secondary homes, and it could be even a little higher with this resort community. So the actual population impact isn't as much as the impact of the businesses and hotels and restaurants and secondary home necessities. So, yes, we do have concerns, but we're actually looking forward to some of those areas of growth, and we will have the means to address them.
Yeah, and I guess one of the concerns then is where do you put the people that need to service those developments?
Correct. And in the current approval process on the density determination, there's been approved with that several hundred affordable housing units that go with that right in the Mayflower exit area. And then as the western part of the Extel property, they will have to also provide significant affordable housing there, which will be workforce housing mainly.
All right. What about water rights? I mean, do all of the parcels come with their own water rights?
No, the Jordandale Special Service District has maintained water rights for many of these parcels, and if the properties of development wanted to participate, they've been paying for the right to use those water rights in the future. So those water rights exist. They've been paying for them. Now, some of them will have to be developed. Some of the culinary water comes out of the Ontario Drain Tunnel. They will have to develop some additional sources, which would come probably from deep wells. And so they've got some work to do infrastructure-wise to be able to do that. So this is a many-year process as they start to develop this, and they'll have to put those processes in place. Just the snowmaking portion of the water development is quite intense for the addition to Deer Valley.
Yeah, especially with a season like this one.
Yes.
The Jordandale Special Planning Planning Commission, again, will be overseeing this, and I still can't find where those meetings are noticed on the website.
They should be noticed on the county website. I will
okay.
Look into that, but they are supposed to be noticed there and as well as on the state national or state site, statewide site.
Yeah. Okay.
They're not there. They might be under the planning office itself, but I will look into that.
I'm not aware where. Well, maybe that's it. Okay, because I keep looking for the Jordandale Planning Commission and just can't, and it always redirects me to the planning office, but then that's okay. Well, I'll keep looking. You let me know if you find something. And
then
Doug Smith, again, he will be overseeing this as planning director?
Yes, he's our planning director, and he's continuing. We're anticipating adding to staff this year. We've budgeted for that, anticipating some of the growth. We've got the first hotel project is in for approval right now, which is the hotel over on the Browns Canyon intersection area called the Iroquois Development, over kind of where the lumber company and so forth is over there. And so that they'll be breaking, well, they've already started on putting some foundation, I believe, but we'll be seeing some vertical construction here in the next month or two.
Okay. Meanwhile, we've got Brighton Estates, a long-time platted development course up the Pine Ridge Road. I mean, any development happening there?
No, we're not seeing really anything new there. A couple of years ago, we had put in place a special service district. The people involved in the district did not want to incorporate a tax or do anything to try and improve the roads or the water system, and so the county council disbanded the district. So we're almost in a little bit of a reverse mode there. So it doesn't appear that the landowners want to put the type of money necessary to improve those roads or developments. It has significant access issues, as you're well aware, and as the discussion over the Bonanza Flats area was discussed, that became quite apparent. You know, the roads close seasonally, and they're not real good roads. And so there's a lot of limitations to the area that really don't facilitate a lot of growth.
So is there a water system up there, or people just have their own wells and tanks?
They just have their own wells and tanks, and the first tank is being put in by a property owner up there that owns three or four different lots, and the county required him to put in some fire protection, which required a tank, and so the first actual larger tank is being put in up there, but there still is not a full system for the area, so all those cabins have individual wells or things like that.
Yeah. So how could a fire be fought?
Well, they would have to be done with the tankers we would bring in using the ponds and the other sources there, so we don't have real good fire protection in that area, and it's been that way since the 1960s, and so that's why we're saying if we're going to facilitate additional growth, these systems have to be put into place that would allow that type of a growth, and the people that own the properties up there just haven't been willing to get everybody together to put that type of financing together. The county's not going to pay for it, and so it'd be up to the developer to do that.
Yeah, I had heard that there were like 5 building permits, though, for new development there. Again, I mean, if they can't fight a fighter, how can you sign off on something like that?
On individual cabins, they'll be required to have sprinkler systems. They'll conform to the state wildland fire code, and so they'll have to have individual sprinkling systems with an individual bladder or tank capacity to facilitate that. So it's limited, and the square footage of the units are limited, so they're smaller. So there are quite a few limitations to their ability to build up there without fire systems in place.
Yeah. And with regard to Wasatch County working with Rocky Mountain Power, trying to deal with the high-voltage transmission lines there, did the county council have to sign off on that as well?
No, the county council doesn't have anything to sign off. That's just a conditional use permit that goes through the planning commission, and that's just for the unincorporated portions of it. A lot of the line is actually in incorporated areas in Heber City, Midway, and the county doesn't have anything to do with those. But just in the unincorporated areas, it's just a conditional use permit.
Right. Of course, we've got an invigorated group of residents trying to stop that. Is it too late?
I don't know, really. I haven't been terribly involved with that. I guess anything can happen, but it appears to me that, you know, in many of the places the lines are already there, it's just an upgrade to a larger line. And so I don't know that that's going to be able to be stopped.
Earlier this last year, I guess, the council looking at ways to provide affordable housing for city and county employees. Any updates on that?
Yes, they're continuing to work on that plan. Scott Loomis with the Mountain Line Group has been working with the county and upgrading our plan to facilitate more affordable housing. And as I mentioned, like up in the Jordanelle, we have incorporated some of those projections into the requirements for those developers, and there will be several hundred units being developed up there for affordable and workforce housing.
Yeah, I think you had done an affordable housing needs assessment at one point. I mean, what kind of deficit are you facing? Any idea?
I don't know the specific numbers. We're a little bit different than the Summit County Park City area in that our mean two areas, when the average wage is much lower than it is in the Summit County Park City area, and then also the market value of properties is lower, and so we have different requirements, and as we lower or provide accessibility into those affordable areas, we have to be careful that they apply to the residents of our county, so we're not providing affordable housing strictly for other areas. And so we've been working quite closely with Park City and other areas to try and get this balance together. Certainly transit comes into this, and we've been having a lot of discussions with Park City on these transit issues and Summit County. And so I think from a regional standpoint, there's a lot of things that need to be done, as well as just in Wasatch County. And we are trying to come up. We had the needs assessment, which we are hoping will revise our code, which is what Mr. Loomis is helping us with right now. And so once we get the code revised, then our plan can proceed.
Yeah. And for anybody who has to travel along 248 this time of morning, any transportation ideas being floated in terms of people who need to travel from Wasatch County to the Park City area?
We have been in discussions with Park City and Summit County on how regional transit and transportation issues will be addressed, along with the Mountain Land Association of Governments. And so that is an ongoing thing that we recognize. We need to have more cooperation with our neighbors. We have a lot of commuters out of our area into Park City and Summit County. So that will be an ongoing issue that we're going to have to continue to address.
All right. Finally, just anything else on the agenda for this year, Mike, that you wanted to mention?
Well, we do have our new open lands committee and group getting together, which is going to look at the possibility of Wasatch County implementing a bond to then to acquire open space. And so they're just starting to put the group together. We're getting names, and the group will be formalized in the next month or two. And we'll start to meet to come up with a plan of what Wasatch County wants to do for open space. And that will be interesting to see how that progresses.
Okay. We'll wait and see. Hey, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
That's manager of Wasatch County, Mike Davis. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. 826 now. Good morning. Well, Park City Council members-elect Steve Joyce and Tim Henney, along with Mayor-elect Eddie Bierman, will be sworn in at a special meeting tonight, 5 o'clock on the third floor of the Park City Library Community Room. Then they'll get right down to work tomorrow when they meet for the first time, starting at 4:15 in work session in the studio with a rundown of the agenda. City Manager Diane Foster. Good morning.
Good morning.
First up, everyone invited to today's swearing-in ceremony?
Everyone is invited. It'll start at 5 o'clock, and Judge Shauna Kerr is presiding. Former Mayor Brad Olch will welcome the crowd, and we've got some readings on leadership from Mary Krista Smith. So I think it'll be a nice event, and it's at the Library Community Room, and the community is invited to attend.
Great. Tomorrow at 4 o'clock, a presentation of the short-term rental market. What are we looking at here? I mean, is it just it sounds like we've hired a firm to look into the issue for both Park City and Summit County?
We have. And this one Tom Fisher talked a little bit about yesterday. And this one I think is quite interesting because the gentleman that we've hired, he's a college professor, and he started about 10 or 15 years ago looking at the short-term rental market when it was really in a nascent stage. And he became an expert in this field, and he's done a lot of work in other resort communities. And he's actually spent the summer in Park City on sabbatical doing studies for other resort communities. He just chose to stay in this one with his family. And so the city, county, and chamber have hired him to the first phase is to look at a market assessment, just to understand what have we got for all of our housing and who's using it and how are they using it, both so that we can look at over time what kind of changes happen to that rent to that housing market, as well as he's got a lot of experience in best practices and things we can do. So once he has an opportunity to look at the market, then he can come back in phase two and provide some recommendations on things that we can do that comply with state law but might tighten that up a little bit.
So on December 8th of last year, there were 4,249 listings on Airbnb and HomeAway for Summit County. About 1,000 of them were outside of the city limits. So when you talk about maybe 3,200 of these units within the city limits, and we have a total of 10,715, that's almost half.
It's a huge number. It's a big issue. It's something that the city council has asked us to take a look at, and that we think it's a regional issue that we do need to look at in conjunction with the chamber and the county, and we appreciate their leadership on this. This is a big issue. It's something we do have. The city has a significant number of, I think it's around 2,200, something like that, of licensed nightly rentals, but there are a lot of unlicensed ones. And I know you asked Tom yesterday about some software the city had purchased in conjunction with the Colorado Association of Ski Towns. We had purchased some software. The folks who operate in the nightly rental business, Airbnb, VRBO, et cetera, they filed a lawsuit against some of these firms, and that firm actually went out of business. So they no longer operate that software. And right now, there's nobody in that market for that who's making software. And if you look at Utah state law, it is now illegal for us to, we used to, in our building department, they used to have a wall that they called any guess where this is, because one of the things that folks who didn't want to pay taxes figured out was if you don't put your address on it, the nightly rental, it's harder to enforce. Well, now, and so there used to be a wall that you could go up to and say, oh, do I know where that place is? And people would try to identify them, as well as the ones with addresses our team would go out and enforce. State law has now made that illegal for us to even go online and do a search as government.
Okay, so we're just protecting people's property rights and the ability to do what they want with them, huh? I mean, are there
talking? That has been, one of the perspectives at the state, and actually Matt Dias, who handles all of our assistant city manager, who handles all our legislative work, he's worked quite closely with Representative Notwell. And honestly, the bill that came out last year is a much more reasonable version than what we saw initially. So while it does, the people on the side of this who there is a perspective of, they call it home sharing, where, there were a few people who testified at legislative hearings that it's the only way that they can make ends meet is to rent out a room. And that's completely reasonable. We support people in doing that. We just want them to do it legally and safely, right? The reason that the city regulates these is twofold. Most importantly is public health and safety, making sure that people have fire access and making sure that if you do have somebody come into your home, that it's a safe place for them. You know, our intent is that your house is a safe place for you as well. But sometimes, particularly in older homes, they don't meet the current codes, and we need them to do that. And things like fire extinguishers are important. The other piece is taxes. You know, on a level playing field, we have a great relationship with the lodging community here, and it's really important to us that that it is a level playing field with nightly rentals and hotel rooms.
So are you saying that they all of these short-term rentals must get some kind of permitting from the city?
They do. They need to be inspected. They need to have a business license.
And that's, again, Utah law does permit that.
Does permit that, yes.
Okay. Let's see. There was also an article, and I would encourage people to go online and read the packet, but there was an article there asking, did Airbnb kill the mountain town? I mean, did it?
You know, I think if my husband works in the resort industry, and I spent a long time in that industry, and finding a nightly rental, when I lived in Maine, I rented for $100 a month. That's what my rental was. And I rented a house with 15 friends. And that's what it's like in ski towns. If you look at a lot of our long-term rentals that used to provide a place for a lifty or a server on Main Street, they now are a nightly rental, and someone can charge an exorbitant amount of money during Sundance or over the Christmas holiday or over February vacation, and sometimes they'll make as much money as they do in a long-term rental. And so I don't it's not something that we disagree with as a city. It's just we want to make sure we have a handle on it. We want to make sure it's regulated properly. And it is important for us to make sure that we do have places for seasonal people to live.
A joint discussion with the Planning Commission with regard to Treasure Hill at 5 o'clock. We had heard that the staff and applicant would be working very hard over the holidays to have some better drawings and schematics. Nothing in the packet. So what are we going to talk about?
I do. I appreciate that you've highlighted staff working over the holidays. There were a number of people who canceled holidays. People canceled their time off. We extended vacations, et cetera. And thanks to the whole planning staff and specifically Community Development Director Ann Laurent, Planning Director Bruce Erickson, and Francisco Astorga. That being said, a lot of other folks have been working on this, not just it includes affordable housing folks, a lot of other planning staff just working on a lot of logistics, but we also have the Water Department, the City Engineer, the Building Department, lots of different folks, and even our Environmental Regulatory Manager, all providing input on this. So what you'll actually see tomorrow is primarily, number one, that the applicant, represented by Craig Call, who's their attorney, he'll be providing updates on progress. And actually, we are, while we, you know, I think everyone would love to see exactly what it will look like. We're not going to, I don't expect we're going to see that this week. We will see progress this week. One of the things that we're very happy about is, and I believe that Think is also pleased with, the applicant yesterday met with the Think group again, is that they've hired an architect. And that's a really important step. And that architect is now working directly with our planning department. And this part's really important because in this type of agreement, the settlement agreement, we're actually able to specify a lot more than they would have in the planning discussion. So exactly what the gross square footage will be, what the net square footage will be, et cetera. Now, I expect we're going to see that in the January 10th Planning Commission meeting and the January 11th City Council meeting. So tomorrow night they're going to come in and they're going to provide some updates on what's going on. Our engineer has been working tirelessly with an outside firm who's got a lot of high-tech software evaluating access and road options. The good news there is that, as you may know, and the applicant came into the initial Planning Commission meeting and the City Council meeting a few weeks ago and came in with three options. Unanimously, across the Planning Commission and the City Council, they were all in favor of the version that moved it to the north, more over into the Gulch, And there are questions there of how the road access looks. So far, no fatal flaws, and they're going to be doing continuing the evaluation on that. So the hotel to the north looks like the preferred option, and we are looking forward to seeing exactly what the applicant's going to come in with tomorrow. We expect that either tomorrow morning or it may be closer to the actual time of the city council meeting, we'll actually see what the applicant has. Sometimes they just present, you know, in the last meeting we didn't have in the packet the locations, and they presented that during the meeting.
Okay, so I think it was option C that I had heard from the meetings a couple of weeks ago.
Option C is the preferred option right now. It's also, I just want to also let folks know that Steve Joyce has made a decision to, he had a choice whether to continue on Planning Commission with this process and then not participate as a city council member. He could participate in, as if he chose to stay on Planning Commission, he could have participated in everything except for treasurer as a city council member. He has chosen to take his full role as city council and step off the Planning Commission at this point.
Okay. So will his position be replaced, or do we just move ahead with who we have?
I don't expect we'll be replacing them, although this is a good opportunity to remind folks that we have both an open city council seat, and I believe those applications are due on Friday of this week, and we do have some applicants already, so please do throw your hat in the ring if you're interested. We did have 17 people show up for the event where we kind of talked about what that would be. We will have additional Planning Commission openings. I have a meeting at 9 o'clock, and I'm asking the folks then exactly when we're planning on advertising those. But we think that some folks who aren't appointed to the City Council may be interested in Planning Commission. But I do not expect that we'll ask someone to come on in the middle of this process, which we hope to conclude by January 24th.
So will Adam Strawn be staying on then as well?
Adam Strawn has agreed to stay on the Planning Commission for this process. And we as have all the planning commissioners, a number of whom have also had their terms extended. So we really do appreciate all the tireless effort that group has put in and appreciate them bringing it home.
All right. So we had expected to see something concrete by the meeting of the 18th then? Or are you meeting on the 25th, actually?
City Council is actually going to be meeting on the 23rd just because of some travel schedules. So that they had decided that last year. And then there'll be a Planning Commission meeting on the 24th. We're expecting everything to be wrapped up by then. And actually, I will say, having been at the last two Planning Commission meetings and the last council meeting, I was quite impressed with what the applicant did bring in and did bring in some options that everyone liked. So I am very much looking forward to seeing what they're going to be coming forth with both tomorrow night as well as especially at the Planning Commission meeting on the 10th and then the City Council meeting on the 11th.
Okay. And real quick, when does the $6 million get paid?
That will be after the settlement. I expect that would be in the late January, early February timeframe. It would be after a settlement agreement was finalized.
Okay.
And if that doesn't happen, then it goes back to the Planning Commission.
All right. Real quick, a $240,000 contract up for approval for change in service with UTA. Is this also being paid by Summit County? So we're talking about almost $500,000?
It is. I believe that is the joint figure in there.
And what does that pay for?
That pays for the increased service. So this is actually a technical correction. The dollar figure was a little bit off. We originally adopted this. The City Council approved this in May 25th of 2017. That was for, we doubled the service to the SLC Connect service down to Salt Lake. So we've got more runs down to there, and this is specifically the dollar figure associated with that increased service, that $240,000.
Okay. Real quick, the coffee shop at the library, do we have a new vendor there yet?
We are in RFP stage. I believe they've got RFP submittals, and we are hopeful for that. Included in that, we did go out for an initial RFP, and one of the applicants came back and asked if we could combine the city's own coffee service, just like any other company, we have a coffee service. And that bidder pointed out that it would be more financially viable and financially stable if they could roll that in. So we the city council decided they would go back out to RFP because it was substantially different and the other bidders didn't have an opportunity to look at that. So we've now gone back out with that. One of the things that I'm excited about is, as a city, we'll be putting in more tenant improvements, probably about $10,000 worth of improvements, making it feel a little bit more like a coffee shop. You know, it's well used now. We think we can even increase the utilization by putting in some rugs, putting in some partitions, couple couches, things like that. And our intent there is that is a community amenity that people have been really excited about.
I had heard one vendor was interested, but the was told that the city would not allow them to hire teenagers.
No, we think teenagers are great employees. We did hear from our prior vendor that because some of their staff were not, they had trouble staffing. And, you know, I think a lot of coffee shops do employ teenagers, and it's a great place to get a first job. It is a difficult, you know, in this economy with the unemployment rate so low, it is difficult to hire folks. So we do understand that. And we're not, as a city, we don't make a profit on this. And we are providing a subsidized rent for someone to be in there.
Okay. Hey, Diane, leave it there. Thanks for your time this morning. Well, it was an exciting weekend here in Park City as ski jumpers and Nordic combined athletes battled it out for a winner-take-all Olympic qualifying event at the Utah Olympic Park. In the studio with a recap of that, another Team News spokesman, Tom Kelly. Good morning, Tom.
Well, good morning, Leslie.
So let's start with the Olympic trials at the Olympic Park. Looks like you had great weather for it, that's for sure.
Yeah, what an amazing weekend. We figured this would be a pretty big event, but we had no idea that we would put over 10,000 people into the Utah Olympic Park over the 2 days, including a 7,000-person crowd on Sunday. Largest event ever at the Utah Olympic Park since the Olympics. And what an exciting weekend it was. First of all, in the Olympic trials for Nordic combined on Saturday, and this is a winner-take-all activity. The only person who got an Olympic ticket is the person who won. And it was a tightly packed race in the Nordic combined field. Brian Fletcher, a minute 24 back after the jumping, came from behind in the last lap to pass Adam Loomis and Ben Loomis to take the win. And Brian Fletcher, going back to his second Olympics, a Steamboat native who now lives here and trains at the Utah Olympic Park and raising a family. And we just had him on the air here a week ago on KPCW. So he has ticked off a ticket to the Olympics. And then on Sunday in the ski jumping competition, first of all, on the men's side, Will Rhodes from Park City, one of the favorites going in, along with Kevin Bickner. But it was a wild card, Mike Glaster from the Norgie Ski Club in the northwestern suburbs of Chicago, who picked up the win. And he'll be going to his first Olympics. And in the women's field, five women vying for the with a chance to win that spot. And Sarah Hendrickson just putting on a dominating performance to win both rounds and take the victory. And she's going back to her second Olympics. So great weekend on the Olympic trials, and those who didn't make it are heading back to the World Cup Tour and trying to make the team, which will be announced sometime the week of January 22nd.
All right. What about Nina? Any updates on her after, I guess, tearing her ACL, huh?
Yeah, a tough break for Nina Lucy. She's having a great season right now, a skier out of Lake Placid who has had good success on this hill. She won a U.S. championship here 3 years ago. She landed a 97-meter jump. Good jump, put her into second place on the second round of the competition on Sunday, but fell on landing and tore her ACL, and she's going to stick around town and get her surgery done here and get back. So she will be out for the season, but I think we'll see her back next year. A really tough loss, a good ski jumper and a great person, but unfortunately that is a part of the sport, and she will be out for the season.
The annual Tour de Ski is underway in Switzerland. Tell us about this competition.
Pretty amazing competition so far from the USA, and a little bit of breaking news coming from today's stage in Oberstdorf, Germany. The Tour de Ski is seven stages this year, much like the Tour de France, covering three countries, three stops, and that's seven races in 9 days. So far in the first 3 days of competition in Lenzerheide, Switzerland, three podiums for the USA, 1, 2, 3. All of a sudden, we're on the podium in every single race in the Tour de Ski. Sophie Caldwell finishing second in the freestyle sprint, Sadie Bjornsson finishing third in the first distance event. In fact, that is the first American women's podium in a classic skiing distance event. And then Jessie Diggins coming back and finishing third in the freestyle pursuit on Monday, New Year's Day, in Lenzerheide. In news today from Oberstdorf, this was to be the classic sprint day, an event won by Sophie Caldwell a few years ago. Weather forecast forecast had been for heavy rain and heavy winds starting at about the time of women's qualifying this morning. That came in with an absolute vengeance. They did conclude the women's qualifying, but heavy lightning started to break out right at the end of the race. They then canceled the men's qualifying, canceled the entire competition for the day, so nothing will take place. But a pretty wild storm. Talking to one of our coaches, he reported that a huge microburst came in between the women's and the men's qualifying, took down a couple of gigantic trees that fell across the test track. So FIS and the organizing committee wisely canceling that competition for the day. They hopefully will get things back underway tomorrow. But right now for the USA, two women, Sadie Bjornsson and Jessie Diggins, in the top 10 in the Tour de Ski with now three stages remaining.
Okay. On the Alpine team, Michaela Schifrin on a roll.
Total role right now. Michaela Schifrin has won five out of the last six World Cup events in the slalom in Lienz last week, picking up a win, and then in the dual slalom in Oslo on New Year's Day. She took a 1/100th of a second margin over Wendy Holdener from Switzerland into the final round, picked up a little bit more time there to get her 37th career win. That ties her for the sixth most World Cup wins of any woman. What's interesting now is today, they're racing in Zagreb. First run is in the books, and Michaela Schifrin with a 1.41 second lead over Wendy Holdener. You can watch it right now on Olympic Channel. Michaela should be going out sometime around 9:25 or so this morning in Zagreb in a night race there. So that would just put her in a commanding position right now in the slalom standings.
Great. All right. And what's coming up this week then?
Still a big week. Tour de Ski continuing, hopefully in Oberstdorf, Germany tomorrow, and then on to Val di Fiemme, Italy. We'll be watching for Liz Steven coming up on Sunday in the hill climb event up Alpes Cermis, and you can watch that one live on Olympic Channel and also same-day coverage on NBCSN of that stage. Freestyle is back in action with moguls up in Calgary this weekend, still in that Olympic qualifying period, and the aerialist in Moscow for a single aerials event. Everybody comes back home, and then next week, early this year for the Deer Valley World Cup. That will be next Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, so coming up a week from today at Deer Valley. And then the Alpine team, women in Zagreb today, men in Zagreb tomorrow. Ted Ligety considering entering that slalom. I haven't heard an update on that, but the men then head to Adelboden, Switzerland for this weekend. Big giant slalom and slalom weekend for Ted Ligety there. The women heading to Kranjska Gora for more technical races and more opportunities for Michaela Schifrin to win World Cup ski races.
Yeah, so with the lack of snow, I mean, do we have any half pipes up and built and ready to go?
You know, snow's been interesting. First of all, in Europe, it's generally been pretty good. We did move some races this week, and the women moved from Maribor to Kranjska Gora. Here in the States, of course, it's been a little bit more challenging. We have good reports from snowmass. We'll be there with the Toyota U.S. Grand Prix at the end of next week. We do have the green light there for both slopestyle and halfpipe, so they've been able to get that going. We'll have teams training there beginning this weekend. I think, actually, we've had a few athletes there over the weekend. Lindsey Vonn, actually, separate from that, Lindsey Vonn was training at Aspen Highlands over the New Year's break. So, you know, snowmaking has really allowed things to be good. And I think as folks saw here over the holiday, you know, we don't have a lot of natural snow on the ground, but what we do have is staying, and the skiing actually was pretty decent. So thank goodness for snowmaking.
Yeah. Tom, thanks. We'll see you next
week.
Thanks,
Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:51.
This Winter Games update is made possible by Westminster College. WestminsterCollege.edu.
8:51, good morning. Well, the Slam Dance Film Festival returns to Park City later this month with another lineup of world premieres and some free programming for film fans as well. On the phone with a preview is the co-founder of the Slam Dance Festival, Peter Baxter. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
So let's just start with the basics. You'll be here when and back at Treasure Mountain Inn?
Yes, we're excited to come to Park City here and begin our festival on the 19th of January. Our festival runs the 19th to the 25th, and we kick off with our opening night film on the 19th, Pick of the Litter, which is by Dana Nachman and Don Hardy. And some might remember Dana's previous film at Slamdance, Bat Kid, which sold very well. It was one of the big sellers in Park City 2015. And here she has a follow-up called Pick of the Litter, which follows a litter of puppies from birth through the day they make it to become a guide dog and into hands of a blind person or get cut from the program. And what's really extraordinary, I think, about this film is that it's been so beautifully crafted from the puppy's POV, and I think it's sure to be a very popular audience favorite in Park City this year. We're very excited to show it as our opening night film.
Oh, you think? Dogs in Park City? Yeah. You're sold out already. With the sale of the Treasure Mountain Inn, is this going to be the home for the festival for the foreseeable future?
That's our plan, and that's our vision. And Andy and Thea, of course, it's a very important day for Andy today as he becomes mayor. But our new manager there, Pat Quigley, has really welcomed us, and we're really excited to bring Slam Dance to Treasure Mountain Inn this January. And to continue with the festival, we love it at Treasure Mountain Inn. It's been an amazing location for our filmmakers. And, you know, if we think about it over the years, some of the biggest filmmakers have walked down those hallways. And this is the place where they got their start. And speaking of which, we're going to welcome back Joe and Anthony Russo this year. Their film Pieces in 1997. Premiered there, and like all the filmmakers at that time, that festival, they were trying to get noticed, and it was a struggle. But Steven Soderbergh saw the Russo's film and offered to make their next production, which was Welcome to Collingwood. And from there, they've had this amazing career, but they've never forgotten Slam Dance. They've been a key part of our community. They've always been there for us, given back, helped mentor alumni, and they are providing this incredible new prize that we have at Slam Dance this year, which is a $25,000 cash prize, but as importantly, mentorship for a new project from a filmmaker. And they're going to be giving that at their new studio in Los Angeles, and incredibly successful. I mean, they're just finishing off cinema's biggest budgeted movie of all time. It's the Avengers film, and we're going to be giving them an award as well. We're going to be giving them the Founders Award at Slam Dance, and they'll be with us during the first weekend. And they're going to be taking part also in our Polytechnic program, which, as you mentioned earlier, is a free program for everyone to come and enjoy about really sort of advancing the education and technology that's involved in crafting independent film these days.
So what is that? Tell us what that would look like, I mean, for somebody who would walk in and see this.
Well, the Polytechnic program has really come about because of what our alumni have told us over the last few years, things which they had wished that they had known but didn't before they had started making their movies. And so what we've done is that we've now got, like Joe and Anthony, a great group of educators who are active, who are creating right now, and want to give back then to our community and also to our audience members. So one of the great relationships that we've really been fostering over the last 2-3 years is that with the University of Utah. So we actually do have educators from the U coming as well, but also we want to see film students as well from the U and also from the community college and really anywhere in and around Utah. We welcome them. It's a free program, and it's very important to us that we have kept this free and open. And so it's going to be a daily program then of these Polytechnic programs. They are from noon until 1:30 every day. I think perhaps one of the key highlights of this program is going to be Lance Wyler's The De-escalation Room, which I think represents really the sort of further developing of forms and functions of storytelling. You know, stories that have the power to do so much more than just entertain us. They can be used as tools of inspiration, motivation, healing, and education. And with the De-escalation Room here, we have the ability to explore our own lives, use them to explore real-life opportunities to de-escalate real-life situations, which you could say is woefully needed in today's heavily polarized landscape, especially through social media. This project has come about actually through Chicago gangs that were escalating a situation through social media. And one of the students at Columbia University saw this and took it to Lance, and they from this have developed the de-escalation route. So that will be on Sunday at Treasure Mountain Inn, and that will begin, as I mentioned, at noon. So we're very excited to have that.
All right, we have
headline our polytechnic program.
We just have a minute left. Tell us about the feature competition lineup. How many films you got there?
Well, we have 27 features this year, over 100 films in total, including the short films. It's really representing, as you know, the unfiltered voice of independent artists to audience. And we were an artist-led and artist-driven organization that I think sort of influences media culture and has discovered commercial trends before others do. And you can expect to find that from our program this year.
All right. And then in terms of more information and ticket sales and all of that, where do people need to go?
To Sandlands.com, our website, where there's a schedule up already. And we have a few passes left, of course. Very importantly, thank you for asking. We have locals passes left still, and they are discounted. They're $150 for the entire festival. So if you go onto Sandlands.com, you can find your way to buying those passes.
Okay. Hey, Peter, good luck. Thanks for your time this morning.